welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with the echo that doesn't go away until now. My very special guest is the wonderful Gaelic philosopher, none other than Thomas Sheridan. Welcome to the program, bro.
Hey, Vinny. Do you want to see a Charlie Sheen? Do you want to see a Charlie Sheen chemtrail? Do you?
Yeah.
Watch. Look.
It's a line on the mirror instead of the line in the sky. I love it.
I did that one at a talk in England a few years ago, and people were, like, laughing for, like, 20 minutes straight.
Oh, they would do. They would do.
Yeah.
I mean, because, hey, what's not funny about Charlie Sheen's drug habits? In fact, did you ever see the Charlie Sheen roast on Comedy Central? I watched that, and it's just whole bunches of people, you know, all these celebrities and everything like that, just for basically a straight hour giving him abuse about hookers and blow. It was classic.
Now, when he said Charlie Sheen roast, I'm thinking, like, he's burning the rocks under his crack pipe or something. Sorry, Charlie, sorry.
Yeah, we mean no offence.
No offence, man. I'm sure you're a nice fella. I'm sure you're a nice fella.
Yeah, I mean, well, he probably shares a lot of it, you know. That's all that's really counted, you know. You can do as much drugs as you want, just as long as you give me some. Now, anyway, the reason I've got you on here, bro, is because we recently went through a number of turmoils with your health kind of thing, but you went to a doctor and found out that there was nothing wrong, which would lead us to believe that there's some kind of psychological or stress type situation involved here. Could you kind of explain the whole process that you've been going through just recently? I understand things have been quite tough for you.
Well, I didn't know this was going to be the subject tonight. It's a good thing I didn't have gonorrhea or something. But anyway. No, well, I have
gonorrhea.
Some kind of
is that a venereal disease that means that you're a goner?
Oh God. I don't know. I mean, I just got these, like, really weird pains for the last few months, right? And it's like I feel fine other way. In every other way, I feel great. These really weird hip pains, and I'm thinking, well, what's wrong with me? And I go to get all these tests and all these, you know, it doesn't cost me anything, but all these expensive tests they've done, and they're telling me I'm perfectly healthy. I'm perfectly healthy. And I'm telling them, well, why do I have these pains in my side? This is, there's no blood, there's no cancer, there's no diseases, there's no nothing. And it's like, and then she says, well, are you stressed out? And I says, well, I'm kind of very busy, but I'm not, like, stressed out like when I used to work in, like, the corporate world, or even when I worked in a factory. That was much more stressing. And so there's all kinds of theories I'm being attacked, and this kind of thing, which I don't feel it, really. But I don't know. It's kind of weird. It's kind of weird when you have this thing and people say to you, and the doctor says to you, they have all these machines, you know, they have all these computers and everything, and they take like so much blood from you and so much all kinds of other body fluids, right? And then they say, oh, you're in perfect health, and yet you're in pain. I mean, what is their purpose?
Obviously, you can't be in perfect health. You know, it's like, yeah. Those people who are perfectly healthy, everybody who's healthy walks around in constant pain and agony, don't they? You know, that seems perfectly reasonable to me.
I'm wondering now, like, are you fluoridated down there? You are, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, now I'm starting to wonder if something like that, you know, like years and years of fluoride. Even though I've been taking out the fluoride for a while now, that accumulation is in there from even washing it, gets through your skin and everything.
Yeah, so you can't get rid of it. Gets into your bones.
Oh, yes, yeah. Well, you can get rid of it the same way you get rid of heavy metals, but it still takes years and years.
Yeah, but, I know.
It's probably some shit like that. Or maybe it is, maybe it's psychosomatic or something like that. I don't know. Who knows? I don't know. But it's like, nothing like this ever happened in my life. You know, it's never happened. So it's a bit weird. But there you go. What can you do?
Oh, well, I'm
still here. They haven't killed you yet.
Yeah, well, let's hope not. And it happens all the time, I found. Like, people have these really phantom sort of illnesses, and the medical system just has no idea. And then half the time they'll go to some sort of naturopath or alternative doctor, and they'll go, oh, you're magnesium deficient. Just give you a supplement, and you're right as rain in like 24 hours or something like that. I see that kind of stuff happen all the time, but not sure if that'd be what's happening here. But, you know, purpose of having you on here was not only to discuss all this kind of stuff and the things that you're going through, but also just to, you know, have a few laughs, have a good time, and help cheer you up at least.
Oh, well, thanks. I very much appreciate that. I'm always good for a laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
My motto is feck them if they can't take a joke.
Yeah. Now, speaking of which, there was this really interesting element that we discussed during the psychopath roundtable, is that psychopaths are infectious. And I was kind of thinking to myself, like, I'm kind of engaged in a little kind of private war with a psychopath on my own ground at the moment. And I was just wondering, how long do you go up against them before they start to infect you with their scumbaggery?
You mean like when you kind of sink down to their level, is that way?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, you'd never sink down to, if it's a real psychopath, you'd never sink down to their level. You just wouldn't. But yeah, that's the whole point. They try to push your buttons. You know, it's why big nations, big bully nations, pick on small nations. Why? Because they know they can beat them in a war. So they agitate them constantly, you know, like, the big name, and it's the same thing with the bully psychopath. They constantly agitate because they know they can take you down, because they will go to the depths that you, a normal person with normal decency, would never sink to. I mean, you would you would have this morality, compassion. You'd say to yourself, well, if he or she is a piece of dirt, right? And they've sunk so low, I'm not going to go that low because he has a wife or kid. And that I wouldn't want them involved in it. You know, that kind of a thing where a psychopath would think nothing of bringing wives and kids and family members in and as part of the attack upon you. So you'd have to be really pretty debased to get to their level.
Yeah, yeah.
But it does affect you. It does affect you because it affects your relationship with other people too, because you suddenly see the world as a darker place because of this exposure to this individual.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's why I made a little meditation track that allows me to kind of release the tension of the psychopath that I'm up against. And every time I play it for like 18 seconds or so, suddenly all that really anger, that rage, that need to expose that scumbaggery of this particular scumbag just kind of like melts away, and it's like, ah, nice, peaceful, serene, you know what I'm saying? And I don't think that a lot of people who are going up against psychopaths have that kind of benefit of being able to just suddenly shirk off that negativity. It's almost like some kind of a leeching parasite has attached itself to your brain stem and is just sucking the happiness out of your life.
Oh, it's true, because that's really what it's about, energy. But at the same time too, don't be hung up on this hippie bullshit this hippie stuff of you're not on your show now, Thomas. You know, this hippie stuff of loving and trying to be peace, because, you know, rage and anger, like Johnny Rotten has said, is an energy. And that stuff exists for a reason, because you're supposed to get it out, because if you don't get it out, you can get cancer, or you can just, you know, become an alcoholic or a drug addict or something like that, or just your whole relationship with the rest of human race goes wrong. So it's, you know, I mean, I don't know if you're into martial arts or boxing, but it's just as much a good idea to hit a punch bag for a few hours, or that kind of chop a tree down, or, well, you know, chop some wood and that kind of thing. That's nothing wrong with that, because you got to get that energy out, because if you don't, it becomes like this sort of repetitive feedback loop, and it only goes one place, and that's to damage you.
Yeah, a lot of the time I'll just sing angry music. That helps.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's what I do as well. You know, like, I play guitar and I have, like, you know, and I play, I just go mad, you know, like, and that gets it out of me. And that works for me. I believe, like, that loud music today, like metal, punk, the old style hip hop and industrial. They're like the modern shamanic traditions in many ways when you think about it, because they allow people to purge the negativity of an experience out of them in the same way tribal dancing and screaming and shouting and walking on coals would. That's what we do today. And that's why when you go to like these, like, you know, hardcore metal festivals and stuff, you meet the nicest kids because they've channeled it all out in the mosh pit.
Yeah, yeah, it's ironic that, isn't it?
Yeah, because they've got it all out of system.
Well, you know, if I could be so bold as to say, I think this is the reason why psychopaths wound up in control of the music industry, because it's kind of like the vaccine industry, you know, they want to publish, they want to produce the poison as well as the cure so that they get to reap all the benefits.
Exactly, it's just the same thing, and they're all, you know, if you look at all the big music companies, you know, the really big ones like Sony, they're tied up in all kinds of transhumanist technology, and they've got ownership of pharmaceutical companies, and all the board of directors all moved between entertainment, industrial complex, entertainment, military complex, entertainment, this, that, and the other. So they're, it's all tied in. They're all like, you know, I'm all right, Jack, I'll grease your pan if you grease mine. And they know that, they know the music that messes us up, and the music that messes you up. You know what the music that really started messing people up was in the late '60s. You know, like that infamous Coke ad. I'd like to teach the world to see all the hippie kind of. They knew that that music was actually causing problems in people because, like, when they saw the first rock and roll, the rock and roll, say Jerry Lee Lewis, Elvis, Little Richard, they noticed a change in American society at the time because they saw like that white poor people were a lot more relaxed and making friends and hanging out with black African-American people. And that's why they took Elvis and put him in the army. And he went from being, like, that first Elvis album, it's quite hardcore when you listen to it today. You can't believe it's like 1956 or something. And then when he comes out of the army, it's like Blue Hawaii and all this, like, lame-o Hollywood music. And they knew that. They put you on this kind of musical Prozac, like that movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that awful music that plays in the mental hospital all the time. They know exactly what to do with us. And they make our brains fluff so we don't have any kind of purging of the toxins. So we'll have to go for medication to get that. Or anything, you know, TV, or violent video games, all that stuff.
Well, you just need to distract yourself from the reality that life sucks in as many ways as possible, I guess, is the objective.
Absolutely. And it does, you know. I mean, life is pretty rubbish for, you know, when you think of it. Before you kind of wake up, that's when I always say to people, they wake up and they say, I'm depressed about it. I wish I never woke up. And he says, you're actually going to tell me you're happier when you're walking around the shopping mall, when you were happier putting your faith in a football team or a rugby team that didn't win, and you were depressed about it and you got drunk. You would think that was better. And the reality is, waking up frees you of so much of that, even though it puts another kind of element of, you see how these psychopaths run the world, but at another level it does liberate you in so many ways. And that's why they don't want people waking up, and that's why they give them celebrities to sort of wake up for them. You understand? That's the new thing now. They're now giving you wake up celebrities. I don't have to wake up, this famous person will do it for me.
Sounds like exactly the same kind of abdication of responsibility that's been advocated the entire time, doesn't it?
Just like religion. I don't have to be spiritual. I'll just have the bishop and the whatever do it for me.
Yeah, doesn't work very well if you're a prepubescent choir boy. Now, the other element here, which I find particularly fabulous, is the fact that despite waking up, despite realizing that the world's run by corrupt criminal scum, you kind of have to learn how to enjoy your life all over again. And the best part about it is you're free from a lot of distractions because you've now identified that they are, in fact, distractions. Now your life can actually begin. And one of these, one of my listeners yesterday, and I said something real nasty to him. I actually kind of regret saying it now. He was saying, oh, it all sucks. It's all hopeless. And I go, well, then why don't you kill yourself? All right. If you think everything's so hopeless and you're trying to convince everybody to stop fighting against the New World Order, against the scumbaggery, why don't you just put yourself out of your misery and stop disadvantaging everybody else who does actually want to fight? And kill yourself. Now, that may have been really harsh, but my point was, and I don't think I iterated this properly, is that you're still alive. While you're still alive, there is still hope. While there is breath in your body, blood in your veins, you are not yet defeated. The only thing that can defeat you while you're still alive is yourself. So if you don't like yourself, if you don't want to win, what is the point in being alive? You're wasting this precious gift.
Yeah, and if you're going to die, you know, die with honor. You know, jump into a jump off a building holding on to Justin Bieber or something like that. Die honorably.
Oh, babies! You originally had like terminal philosophy. Oh, babies!
But that's another important part of it as well. Although it is a rat hole and it is nasty, never, ever, ever lose your sense of humor, because we need gallows humor now more than ever. More than ever.
Yeah. Well, part of the gallows is lows. And boy, are we going through some lows right now. And I do think that it is the survival mechanism that we need. Okay? You know, like if you go to a triage or something like that, and you've got an arm off or something like that, and they heat up a shovel on a Bunsen burner or something and cauterize the wound with it, whatever. Whatever it takes. Just as long as you stop bleeding and bleating and start getting active, right? Because I found that's another thing that really messes people up. Don't you notice, Thomas, is that the people who are doing nothing are often the ones who are the most depressed about the things that are happening. The people who are doing heaps, on the other hand, it comes and goes.
They're burning the energy out again. Where the ones who are the most depressed are the ones who are spending all day skinning up and watching the most negative videos on the internet, and they're not actually doing anything. And it's like you gotta put intention into action. And when you do that, your brain feels better. You're flooding that dopamine and adrenaline into your brain, and one little victory a week can make all the difference.
Yes, it can. We'll be right back, folks. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. The sun is shining somewhere on Earth, certainly isn't the Northern Hemisphere. My very special guest is Thomas Sheridan, coming at us live. And what I'd like to understand a little bit about you, Thomas, is you've kind of devoted this career to exposing scumbaggery and talking about a whole bunch of other things, not just about psychopaths, even though that's kind of what you're most noted for. I wondered if you'd share with the listeners some of your other interests that have been tickling you recently.
The legal ones. Well, the psychopath thing was an accident that really happened. It wasn't something I planned. It happened quite by accident. It was just sort of art and writing and music and graphic design was what I was doing. And I just said, it'd be kind of neat to write a book on psychopaths. If no one read it wouldn't matter really. It'd be kind of interesting to do this anyway, because it was kind of like the stuff that I've been studying for years. It might be interesting to somebody. And I was amazed that it actually gave me another job. You know, it was like another part-time job came for me. So that was a complete surprise for me. I never, ever was interested that, no, sorry, not interested, but ever never really thought that it would ever happen. Now, what was interesting was that at the time I was doing it, I was far more interested in social engineering, control of perceptions, marketing, and how the human consciousness is attacked by media and that kind of thing, and all these kinds of these perceptive impacts on our consciousness and psyche. And the psychopathic thing was an aspect of that, because ultimately, because the system is psychopathic, I'd found correlations between the two. And so the psychopath thing was written, that book was written out there, but I was always interested in the other stuff more, and always in the background, because they are connected big time, because our perceptions are everything in terms of how we see ourselves, you know, how we view the world, how reality appears to us even. And so that was always my main interest. I was always very, very interested in art, always very interested in human consciousness, how it's perception, very interested in literature, big time. Not to be a stereotype, but I am. And I was interested in psychology. So it was a good sort of addendum to all that stuff. It was appendix, really, in a way. But it was very surprising to me that all took off. And I'm glad it did, because people tell me all over the world it's helped them in their own lives to deal with these creeps at work or bad, you know, toxic and dangerous relationships. And that has been very fulfilling for me. I was very happy that that happened. But my main interest has always been what it means to be a human being in this world in terms of how we perceive our self-identity according to the external stimuli imposed upon us by mass media, education, religion, and law.
Could you give an example?
An example for it? Well, everything really. One example would be, we talked about music earlier on, okay? You can see how, if you go through the history of the world, you can see how fashion and music were one time not connected. Fashion and acting and theater were not one connected, okay? So fashion was developed. If you looked at the fashions of the Victorian times, it didn't, the men didn't wear clothes because Oscar Wilde dressed that way or Henry Irving, the actor, dressed that way. That was the fashion of the time based on how tailors would cut and design cloth. The same for women. The fashions moved in a very kind of an independent way. With the arrival of cinema, and in particular the growth of stars such as Rudolph Valentino, you had changes in how men and women would dress, wear makeup, and you had then the flapper movement. The flapper movement directly came out of how women were portrayed in early Hollywood films. And that went on, that changed, and then it happened with music later. You had the Bobby Soxer movement, which were young women who wore a specific fashion based on, I believe, what jokingly Frank Sinatra said was his favorite style in a woman's clothing in an early advert. So they all became coupled. So therefore, human self-identity was directly related according to realities that are imposed upon them, were not necessarily in any way natural. They were not a product of anything that developed in a socio-cultural sense that had come from the bottom. They were purely imposed upon above. And what made that happen were three things: the cinema, publishing, and the transmission of sound, either wireless radio or music. And that's what changed us as a species in the last 100 years.
Well, in such a way, the saturation of these different forms of media that you're living your life in, you're basically bathing in it, it means that media determines what your desires become rather than your desires determining what the media will become.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I say the most important thing we have to do is to actually make our own media to subvert the mainstream media. Because the mainstream media, because of, you know, a psychotic, psychopathic, vicious, evil pedophile such as Jimmy Savile at the BBC, and how he was protected by not only the upper echelon but the BBC, but nearly all the stars in there that worked with him, as well as the British establishment, shows how dangerous it is that that guy, this monster, this psychotic, vicious pedophile, who is like, you know, even people that knew him said he wasn't human, and I don't even believe he was human, considering like how industrial is the scale of his depravity was. This individual was a prime example of why the mainstream media cannot be trusted anymore, and certainly why nobody ever again in the UK should ever buy a TV license or purchase or support the BBC, because what that was a declaration of war by mass media on the most innocent and vulnerable people of British society, and they hid it, protected it, and kept it going. And what they did is as bad as any war crime, any violation of human rights, and it's absolute disgrace, and taxpayers in Britain have to pay for that.
Now, just recently, Transparency International released its Corruption Perception Index. I like it how they call it a Corruption Perception Index as opposed to a Corruption Reality Index, all right? Because New Zealand and Denmark are first equal as the least corrupt country in the world. I live in this country. I speak to the activists in this country. There is no fracking way that this country is the least corrupt country in the world. I mean, it's more corrupt than the Robert Mugabe regime, for frack's sake. So here's the thing. It's not that New Zealand's not corrupt at all. It's that it's so corrupt that any of the people who would do any of the investigation of corruption are also corrupt. That's how corrupt it is. And in so doing, the society, and that includes the media, doesn't it? Because the media is supposed to investigate corruption, the media is supposed to expose it, but they're not. Why? Because they are corrupt too.
Precisely, yeah. They're probably the most corrupt of all, because they are charged with a mandate to actually report on these things. This is, especially if you have, do you have a national TV network in New Zealand owned by the government?
Yeah,
you have your own. Yeah. You have your own BBC. Well, in countries
TV
like
NZ,
yours,
I call them.
Yeah, in Ireland it's RTE, but they're all like national broadcasters. They're specifically chartered, in theory, to serve the interests of the citizenry, and above anything else, above the government, above anything. And the opposite is true. Every country that has a national broadcaster, the national broadcaster is a propagandist for the plutocracy that runs each and every country they're in.
Yeah. They do the direct opposite of everything that they say they're going to do. That's why they keep away. That's why they keep getting away with these scams for so long. Okay, and people say, "Oh, Vinny, but they can't be true. It just can't be true." Whoa, hold on a second. Are you telling me that if a scam artist came up to you with the intention of scamming you, that they would tell you that they're scamming you before they did so? Is that what you're telling me? Of course they wouldn't. They've got it stitched up, mate. Okay, the government's corrupt, the police are corrupt, the judiciary is corrupt, the reporting's corrupt, and the business is corrupt, and they all work in concert. It's just that simple. No wonder they don't get exposed.
I was just talking about like joking at the beginning when I said the illegal ones, and why I said my illegal interests, and what made me say that was, and it directly relates to what you said. Last week, I was walking through the fields near where I live, and I saw a magic mushroom. Right, one late in the year, a psilocybin mushroom, right? And I was looking at it, and I was just thinking to myself, if I was to pick that up right now and a cop was nearby, I could risk up to 8 years in prison. Yet, the bankers in this country, right, that's a plant, a fungus out of the ground, the bankers in this country were caught on tapes, Anglo-Irish Bank, swindling and hiding their debts in order to get a bailout from the IMF and laughing about it. And the government is deliberately protecting them and delaying the tribunal so the statutes of limitation will be up before they have to go to prosecution. Yeah, I was looking at the ground and I was saying, if I pick up that one illegal fungus that's growing there, just to even touch it, to pluck it, I don't have to even consume it, just to pluck it, I'm looking at 8 years in prison. You tell me that is a sane world. It's not, and that's how corrupt we are. That's how far down the toilet hole we've gone.
Yeah, I've been telling people for a long time. You know, when they tell me, "Oh, I just don't understand that." You know, why would the mushrooms be illegal and ripping off people being the banker as being legal? Oh, I don't get it. Well, it's because you're not a psycho. Okay? Yeah. If you're a complete psycho, suddenly the world would make a hell of a lot of sense to you. The reason why that is because it's run and set up by psychos.
Yeah, it's true.
No, it's like God made us in his image and the psychos made the world in theirs.
Yeah, and you know they have a hatred of nature. I always find that interesting as well. They hate anything natural. They hate anything that nature makes. The earth, and even though they talk about their environmentalism, their ecology, and they have all their TV programs and all the little mandates and all the little climate change summits, you will see that they're so divorced from the natural world, they're not even literally residents of this planet.
There has been that talk by David Icke saying that there is this reptilian kind of conspiracy going on, and he says that it's something along the lines of it's a frequency thing. So if you're capable of shifting your frequency or your code or something of that nature, you can shapeshift, you can change forms and what have you. Now, if you take that literally, it sounds a little bit far out there, but if you take it as an analogy, shape-shifting by changing your frequency. What's frequency? Well, if you have a look at your heart and your emotions and what have you, your body actually gives off particular frequencies when you're feeling certain things. So if they're able to change their frequency per se, they can devoid themselves of having any actual emotions that they don't want. Not only that, but they can mirror your emotions so that they can sucker you in and manipulate you and take you over and mind control you.
And if you, okay, I don't know if there's reptilians or not. I don't, well, other than the lizards that live in the ground, that are in, you know, but I don't know if there's reptilian being shifting humans. I haven't seen any proof there. It could be true. I don't know. But I do get the idea of the reptilian brain and all that stuff. I know that stuff is for real, and that just plays a huge part in psychopaths. However, as we're talking about this energetic stuff, what I will say is many people, in fact, most normal people, when they first encounter a psychopath, right, they have a sense of unease. It's a slight, even if there's not anything particularly creepy about them. See, this is one of the myths about psychopaths, that they're all sexy and cool and dynamic. They're not. Very few are. Most of them have the creep factor big time. They're charmless, a lot of them. But they're very good at flattery. And that flattery and that spinning of love bombing and word salad is what bypasses your intuition. But your initial intuition, if you think back of all the ones you ever met, you're going, even if they're like, hey, Vinny, how's it going, buddy? You know, that kind of thing. You were still thinking inside, something not right there.
I don't know what it is. Recoil.
Yeah, a little kind of intuitive bang kind of hits you. And that's because, according to some people, their energetic frequency that they emit is not quite in sync with us. And we initially encounter them. We're out of sync. Our intuition spots it. But because they start saying things like, I love your radio show, Vinny, it's great. Oh, Thomas, I've seen you. Your books are fantastic. Blah, blah, blah. That's what makes you click in with them. That fires the mirror neurons in your brain to click in with their frequency. They're masters of deception, playing on your neurochemicals. And this is what I think they mean by this whole thing energetically. Now, I will tell you something here, and I swear to God this is true. I have a friend, and I had a friend years ago in New York who was dating.
20 seconds till break.
Who was dating a girl, right? And he told me that they were having a row one night, and he said he swore to, and this guy's not a wise ass. He told me that her eyes pupils went to slits when she was angry with him.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there was also an eye study that found that 4% of people have reptilian eyes. We'll be right back.
Here beside you, can I see your name? Can I just be here? Can I speak in anger? just being here.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I'm a renegade fighter and a lover and a winner. And my very special guest is Thomas Sheridan. Now, we were talking over the break about two things, I think. One was the spiritual aspect of psychopaths. You know, there's plenty of people around the world who aren't psychopaths, who are deeply religious. They draw strength from higher powers, higher consciousness, etc., etc. So there must be a negative spectrum version of that for psychopaths. You know, like dark druids tap in with all the evil souls and what have you. And then there was this other element. Of a psychopath who was having a brain scan. I think it was a murderer or something like that, and they asked him to pretend that he was feeling certain emotions that psychopaths don't generally feel, like love or empathy or something of that nature, and the same areas of his brain lit up as it would as he was a normal person. Just by him pretending, it gave people some cause to believe that, oh, maybe we can reverse the psychopathic nature. I don't know if that's even possible. So first aspect I wanted to get your perspective on is the spiritual aspect. You know, is there like some kind of a I don't know, some dark lord Sauron that psychopaths can put on some kind of metaphysical ring and visit the ethereal dark invisible realm?
Well, they don't seem to have a spiritual aspect to them, either positive or negative. They don't dream, for instance. They don't do art. They don't really have creativity. They don't have deeper insights, which is what I would consider spiritual to be, a sense of a depth beyond this reality. They seem to be very much focused in the moment. You know, they don't have dreams. This is because they're deficient. Well, they're not deficient. Their frontal cortex is switched off. But you know, if you were to ask me, beyond everything, and, you know, I'm this close to being an atheist, but that distance is still pretty big. It's that close, right? And so I'm not, you know, I'm very interested in all spirituality and all religious traditions and everything. I'm very, very interested, actually. But that's a different thing than believing, you know. But I do believe fundamentally at their core that they are a malevolent operating system, a software system, and that had to be programmed somewhere else. And I believe that somewhere else is the root of the whole psychopathic experience. If we could find who or what is doing that programming, if it's even the human race doing it through our collective consciousness, I don't know. But I really do believe that ultimately it comes down to the consciousness, and they have a malevolent consciousness, and that's just the end of it for me. It's nothing to do with their brains. It's nothing to do with their brains, because all the brain parts are there. They're all working. They're just only using the bits they need because they don't care. They don't care. Now, you said about that brain scan, right? Well, any woman can fake an orgasm, right? Any psychopath can fake empathy. But here's the important one. That test, that research they had in Holland, you just referenced a few months back, was pretty rubbish, actually, because I got the actual original research paper. And basically what they showed was that psychopaths could have empathy if they were told to imagine what empathy was like. So again, it's acting. But also, here's the important one. People confuse empathy with compassion. Empathy and compassion are two different things. Empathy just means a social understanding. It's a social connection, an understanding of the person next to a certain needs, the person beside a certain needs. But it's not necessarily a loving or a sort of a transcendental emotional thing. It's not that at all. That's compassion. Compassion is when you can look another person and you can say, oh my God, I feel so bad for them, I'm going to help. That's not empathy, that's compassion. Very important distinction there that these researchers at this program completely missed out on. Another thing too, they were hung up on mirror neurons. Now, this was what was interesting about this tour. Mirror neurons are what actually helps empathy integrate between people, between humans. And it seemed to be that when this psychopath was actually asked to imagine what love was like, his mirror neurons for the first time ever became active. Now, you could say that shows he has empathy. Yes, but empathy is not the same thing as compassion. He was able to understand the concept of love, but that's not the same thing as love. In the same way, faking an orgasm is not the same thing as an orgasm. Now, here's a good one for you. If you were to take, say, D-Day, right, 1944 D-Day, right, those landing craft doors open, those young American lads walk out onto Omaha Beach, it's mayhem, they've seen their friends blown up all around them. You could have several guys there who were good, kind, loving, nice fellas who never harmed religious boys, who never harmed anyone in their lives. But because of the intensity of the situation, by the time they got to those Germans, they were starting to kill them as prisoners. If you were to put them under a CAT scan at that point, if they had fMRI scans back then, you would have found they had the same brain as a psychopath in that moment. However, that does not mean that those fellas were psychopaths. They just had to go into a psychopathic state in order to survive a horrific military engagement. However, when the war was over, they went back home and they were back to being normal again.
Well, many just,
they weren't psychopaths.
There's also those who get damaged by it and suffer shell shock really badly for the
But that's traumatic stress.
That's not psychopathy.
No, that's a different thing. That's because they've been very damaged. That's because that shows they are normal. But they, I think actually this post-traumatic stress comes from they became psychopaths for a little bit, you know, in terms of their neurochemical processing. And I think that's what actually caused the damage. So it's the same thing. It does, just because they were in that position didn't make them psychopaths. And just because a psychopath pretended he knew what love was doesn't make him empathic or passionate.
Is it possible to reconcile? Like, let's say, for example, an ordinary person can turn psychopathic permanently. Is that possible? With the right stimuli? With the right mind control techniques?
Oh, definitely. They could also happen with a virus and things like that. I mean, it could happen with something like syphilis. In the old days, you know, like syphilis could eat away at the frontal cortex of their brain, their amygdala and the limbic regions. Yeah, absolutely it could happen. I'm sure many of these people who are normal and then, you know, got some kind of horrific mental disorder or some accident or even extreme post-traumatic stress and then went crazy killing people in shopping malls. I'm sure that's what happened there. Yeah, and you say they can do it through mind control and stuff. Absolutely they can, because if you can invoke dissociative identity disorder, which is when they partition the brain into different sections, and that's what MKUltra was really about. They were trying to partition different parts of the cerebral cortex in order to create one personality in one and one personality in another. Well, there's no reason why you couldn't actually remove the frontal lobes and limbic region of the brain in terms of like a mind control program or even drugs or even, you know, even like some kind of ray beam or something. And what's frightening about that, Vinny, is DARPA in the United States are actually working on a military helmet that does just that. When they go into battle, it actually fires. It has electromagnetic fields which actually block the limbic regions and the amygdala on the brain, and then they cannot actually process empathy and compassion. And DARPA have this in production. In fact, I have the research paper from MIT. It was leaked to me a few years ago by a professor who was working on the project. And they were actually, they found that if you put electromagnetic fields at certain parts around the skull, you can actually switch off the limbic regions, which cause you to make moral decisions. They're almost like the gearbox of the brain. And they found that when they put them on, so the DARPA said, great. And then they start developing military headgear that would actually switch off the empathy and the compassion in soldiers. So that's how scary it's got.
Now, there's also elements where the brain can be taught how to do things if it doesn't have an alternative. Like, for example, there's these chips that you can implant into the brain. And after a while, the brain will learn how to interface and actually use the chip. Now, I was wondering, you were talking about how they're able to disable the frontal lobes, the amygdala and what have you, in order to produce psychopathy. Is it possible to block and disable the reptilian cortex in the brain in order to force the brain to use the frontal lobes?
No, because the lower brain stem is like first gear, and it's the neck directly connected to your spinal column, directly connected to you know, parts of your brain that process your five senses. Your optical cortex is back there, where it processes your eyes. That's why psychopaths have crazy eyes, because they're all connected down that area, your hearing and so on. So if you were to actually switch off the lower brain stem, what would happen would be the rest of the brain would shut down. It's like force gear. You can't. If you went to a car's gearbox and removed force and second gear, there's no way you could start driving in third, fourth, and fifth. It's the same kind of thing. What they could do is, if they could create, and it would be a good thing if they could do this eventually, but then again, they probably wouldn't do it to the people around the world. Well, if they could develop some kind of chip that could actually function as a sort of a fail-safe in terms of their amygdala, so when they're making the decision that may be psychopathic, the chip may actually become like a fail-safe switch to say, no, you can't do this, in an emotional sense, to make them believe the repercussions will ultimately come back to you.
Hmm. Like in a mental dog collar. You know those little shock collars that they give the dogs, you know, dogs being naughty. Precisely. Or something like... It would be cool if actually the politicians and the scumbags and everything had the little electric collars around them, you know. Bad politicians. Ow! You know, I would actually be really amused by that endlessly. We'll be right back after the break with my very special guest, Thomas Sheridan, ladies and gentlemen, author of Puzzling People, The Labyrinth of the Psychopath. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's now hour number two. It's the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. Ah, sanity. It's a real difficult one to hold on to. It's kind of like paper gold assets, in a way. It doesn't really exist, does it?
No.
You know, it's can you understand, is there a difference between sanity and the perception of sanity? Because I know there's a hell of a lot of people around there who still haven't woken up, and they think that what they're doing is sane. You know, they're getting in their slave monkey suit, they're going to their slave job, stuck in the slave traffic, doing their slave work and what have you, and they think that they're sane, and they think that people with megaphones on the side of the street saying society is fracked are the crazy ones.
Yeah, you see, because in psychiatry and in psychology, there is actually no baseline for sanity. Nobody knows where sanity ends and insanity begins. It's purely an arbitrary, you know, transient line in the sand that means nothing really. You could have people who were alive in the 1920s, if they were brought into this world today, they would think this world was insane. And they'd probably be classified as being insane by psychiatry. For instance, years ago, people would be like less sort of guarded. There would be no political correctness. So they might be more open about their prejudices. Doesn't mean they're evil. It's just how the life was back then. Yet under the DSM today, they would be considered, you know, disabled, psychologically disordered, whatever, or psychiatrically affected. So there's no baseline to sanity and insanity. There just isn't. Now, there are, you can obviously see people who are definitely not well and they're not functioning in the society. And that's what annoys me, because those people are sick and those people are ill. But when somebody holds a different opinion or is eccentric or is, you know, a maverick in some way, this whole thing of you're nuts or you're insane is used as a social control mechanism.
Kind of like political correctness. I figured out that the problem, the whole agenda behind political correctness is to stop people saying what they really think.
Well, political correctness is fascism. I have nothing to do with people. Anyone comes into my life that has overt politically correct behaviours, I know I'm dealing with an absolute muppet. I will have nothing to do with them. Because if they're dishonest in their feelings that way, they're dishonest in every other aspect of life. So, for instance, if they're looking for misogynists and homophobes and racists everywhere, that shows me that they have a fascist nature. And also, if they're dishonest about that, they're dishonest about everything. That's one of my yardsticks for people. Anyone who is overtly politically correct is fundamentally at heart flawed, because a normal compassionate person knows it's wrong to walk up to a black person and say a racial term, or a Jewish person, or a gay person. You don't do that, okay? You don't do it. We know that. We know it would hurt their feelings, because the same. But a person who invokes political correctness, I believe, doesn't actually have those feelings, and they would say them if they didn't put their own brakes on themselves. So I do not trust people. It's the same thing with people who say we need religion in order to have morals. What? It's the same kind of, it's the same crappy argument.
Yeah. When you say that, it reminds me of a lot of the people that I've made videos for, even had on this radio show in the socialist wing in New Zealand here. Some of them overtly politically correct, and then I've seen lots of other instances where they started to attack activists whom I respect, who have never done anything wrong, and lie about them and hold these little socialist kangaroo courts and what have you. So it's actually quite a profound realization that's just hit me because of what you said there.
Oh, yeah, I've had huge problems with socialists. And I've never met a socialist who was a worker. They all seem to be from wealthy or well-off families. They all seem to be doing quite well. To me, they are used as just bullies, as just thugs. The brown shorts of today are these sort of like anti-Nazi leagues, anti-this league, pro-black, you know, all these stupid kind of like white folks who think that they have to regulate other white folks. That crowd, I can't stand them, because they're thugs, because, again, they don't have, you know, decency. So therefore, they assume the rest of us don't have it either. And we have to be regulated by them, because they've discovered decency in the same way a born-again Christian has discovered Jesus.
Yeah. In fact, that was funny. I remember I was at work one time, and I had this really difficult customer who just wasn't being honest with me, you know, kind of thing. And all I wanted to do was get his phone bill faxed to me so that I could actually do a proper analysis of his phone bill. And so he was telling me how much I think his landlines were costing, that they were like $16 each. And I was like, that's not possible. They're at least $40 each. And I knew that we had like this digital version that where they were like $7 each. So I was like, you know what? This guy's probably not telling me the truth. So I'll tell you what, I'll just BS him a little, just so that he can send me his bills so that I can actually go ahead and help him, you know, and actually try and do something for him. And I got the bill, and I said, yeah, all right, thank God. A little bit of BS goes a long way when you can actually help people with it. And I think there was this born-again Christian lady who said, oh, you don't have any conscience, like right in the middle of the floor of all these callers and everything, like really loudly in front of everybody. It's like, freaking hell. And then I pull her aside into the staff room, and I say, why did you say that? She goes, I didn't say it. I didn't say it. And then I go, yep, born-again Christian.
Devil made her do it.
You know, it's when you deny your own faults, that's when you become truly faulty.
Exactly, because then you've denied your own humanity. You've denied, and then what happens is you become a kind of a police, a sort of a moral police of others. Because what happens is you're no longer in control of yourself. I mean, I can honestly say the most politically correct people I've known were also among the most indecent I ever met. They had no decency in them.
Yeah. Well, I think I've got moral authority. I've captured the moral high ground. Therefore, I can not have to abide by it myself and just tell everybody else to. That's totally hypocritical. It's what I call, and when born-agains do that, I call them hypocristians.
Hypocristians, yeah. It's like when they say, what would Jesus do? I tell you what, if Jesus was around, he wouldn't do what you do.
Yeah,
It's what would you do if Jesus was there? He wouldn't do anything what you're doing.
Nah, he probably wouldn't. He'd probably throw you out of the temple along with the bankers.
Yeah, he'd be on shows like this. I've no doubt about it.
Yeah.
If the real Jesus, if you can find him in that text, he was like a radical of his day. And he was ready for a showdown with the psychopathic control grid of the Roman Empire in his day. And in the temple, he was ready for a showdown.
Yeah, yeah. Well, is that possible in this day and age? Because I believe I mentioned this in the first segment about somebody who was kind of like really depressed and saying, oh, it's hopeless, we can give up and everything, and say, you know, go and kind of kill yourself if you think that your life isn't worth living. Stop contaminating the rest of us with your depression. But, you know, it was pretty callous of me, and I regret saying that, as I said. However, is it actually possible to override the system, right? And I thought about it like this. You know how when they tie down those old school Zeppelins or whatever in those big hangars, and they have ropes down on the front and on the back and in the middle and all over the place, right? They got all these different ropes and all these different points holding this one Zeppelin down. And I think that's kind of like how many ropes our minds or how many ropes our countries are bound under the psychopathic elite control structure. So that in order to release and allow your mind to float free or allow your country to be free, all of those ties have to be severed simultaneously. That means all your mind control has to be severed, or your poison food has to be severed, or the chemtrails have to be severed, the corruption, the banking system, and everything basically needs to be taken away simultaneously in order to get any form of freedom back. In order to accomplish this, though, it's what people have been calling the mass awakening. And I had my Facebook status the other day. In order to have critical mass, the masses have to be able to think critically.
They can't. Even many people in the alternative can't think critically. It's unfortunate, but they can't. Mm. They just become the second level of the control system. They jump up into the next level, and they're critical in a new sphere of a new paradigm. What they really have to do is be like a baby and start from fresh, that you know nothing, and you can't carry your baggage with you from before. But I've noticed that. I mean, recently I had a bit of a hullabaloo with the Russell Brand thing, which it wasn't bad for me in the end, but at first I was very badly attacked. And what I'd realized, what these people had just gone from stage one to stage two, and they were still depending on an exterior figure to do it for them. And they assumed I was attacking Russell Brand personally. And if you listen to what I wrote and said, I didn't. I was talking about the stuff he was coming out with, which was, to me, it was like something Bono was coming, like just another celebrity talking through his backside. And so I said, hold on a second, and you shouldn't be externalizing this stuff. But then it made me read that was quite surprising. Now, I have to say, an awful lot of people stood by me as well, but it was quite surprising to me how hostile people who I thought were pretty cool and woken up and were no lot had broken from a Hollywood spell suddenly found that they had this Hollywood leader to follow. Now, that's not to say that some of the stuff he said didn't have merit. Absolutely, it did. But at the same time, too, he was on the BBC. He was, you know, I don't want to get in his personal life, but he's surrounded by bankers, basically. He has an awful lot of money, and he's asking for a redistribution of wealth. Well, why doesn't he give away lots of his money to begin with? You know, it's this kind of thing. And it just seemed to be another Bono, another Bob Geldof, another celebrity talking about this stuff. And I've come to see that there is an element of coaching, of activism among celebrities. But it was interesting for me how many people that I thought were woken up were still the spell of celebrity, the most powerful force on this earth, still had them.
I think it's because we've got this complex that humans do like leaders. We like to be led, don't we? We like to look up to people.
Unfortunately.
We like to find good examples to follow. I mean, like, I got people who look up to me and what have you, and maybe that's not such a bad thing, but then again, at the same time, I'd rather them have faith in themselves than faith in me. You know what I'm saying? I think that's far more valuable. I'd rather somebody stop listening to my show and begin their own rather than listen to me for years and years and years without doing a single broadcast of their own. You know what I'm saying? I don't want to be your savior, ladies and gentlemen. I don't want to be your leader. I'm just trying to help you recognize that you don't need one and stop thinking that I am one just because I'm telling you that you don't need one.
Exactly. You should be your own leader. But at the same time, too, there's nothing wrong with being inspired. I'm inspired by fellows like you. I'm inspired by lots of people that are doing stuff that you're doing. But at the same time, too, you don't follow me, I don't follow you, but we both say, I like what he has to say about this, good, it's important, and I'll share it with other people. That's a different thing. What I don't like is the celebrity aspect, the worst, this sort of idolization, because somebody's famous and they're among the rich and famous, therefore he then has validated all those years of my friends and family thinking I was a nut because I said vaccines don't work. You know, that kind of a thing. And it becomes a compensatory mechanism. And therefore, you abdicate your own personal responsibilities as being a woken up person to your celebrity. And that's a dangerous road to go down. And all I wanted to do was say to people, put the brakes on. Just put the brakes on.
Yeah. Well, I think that's perfectly rational, isn't it? It reminds me of the album cover of a Korn album called Follow the Leader. And they got a hopscotch Squares leading off of a cliff. And I'm thinking that's kind of what's happening now with celebrity culture and government, and a whole bunch of new political parties have started to come out and things like that, garnering people's support and what have you as an alternative to the mainstream. But it's just another mainstream alternative, for frack's sake. Why can't people see? It's all a scam. It's just a scam reinventing itself so it can continue to scam you. Sweet mother of mercy. Why can't you see it?
Yeah, no, it is. It's like, I even predicted in England a new left party was coming out. Sure enough, Unity Left is here. It was like, I said, I should be in Las Vegas, like, rolling the dice. It's got so predictable at this point. They just give us new scams to follow.
Yeah.
Same old rubbish.
Yeah, well, the parliamentary roundtable is a crap table, I'll give it that much. It does belong in Vegas. Especially with all the gambling derivatives. Now, I was thinking, of course, that this element of a savior complex, and you mentioned this word inspire, okay? Inspiration. If somebody makes you feel happy to do nothing, that's not inspiration, okay? They're just entertainment. If somebody's words motivate you to stop doing what you're doing and course correct, that's inspiration. That's the kind of thing you should be looking for. Don't look for things that make you feel comfortable. Look for things that make you uncomfortable. Uncomfortable things make you change. Those things that you want to enjoy, the entertainment, the frivolity, the whatever it is that you've got in your life that makes you stop yourself from making a difference in the world, that is the thing that you shouldn't be paying attention to.
A grain of sand in an oyster shell makes a pearl. Make a pearl.
Yeah, precisely. And I think it's a good one, actually. The grain of sand in the oyster shell. Much like a seed in an oak tree. And I think that's something Bill Hicks said. I'm just planting seeds. If they take root and they bear fruit, I don't know. I'm just feel better planting them. And this is a great approach, I think, because what truth is in a lot of them, and I think one of my colleagues did a show about what's called truth of snobbery, where we start thinking we're better than everybody else.
They're all sheep and I'm not.
Yeah. The problem is, ladies and gentlemen, everybody else might be a slave, but that doesn't mean that you're free. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com.
unforgettable. That's what you are. Unforgettable. Though near or far, like a song of love that clings to me, how the thought of you does things to me never before. Has someone been more unforgettable in every way?
Welcome back.
And
welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I also want to encourage people that I've got a very eclectic taste in music, some of which old, some of which new, some of which obscure, some of which popular. And I think that's because it reflects my social circles. A lot of my friends are a lot older than I. And I think of that Nat King Cole song, Unforgettable. Have you ever seen the film Watchmen, Thomas? No? Oh, it's a great movie for a truther, I think. It's a superhero movie kind of thing, except it's a lot darker than the average superhero movie. It's really violent, and there's a lot of conspiracy and skullduggery and scumbaggery going on in there. High technology, the whole thing. And one of the opening scenes of it is these two superheroes having a really, really massive fight, and one of them being killed, and the theme music for it is Nat King Cole's Unforgettable. You know, so as they're flying around the room, breaking through tables, having their heads slammed through granite bench tops and things of that nature, it's just din 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 din. I like it when people put ironic music, you know, like music that doesn't fit into something completely different, and yet somehow make it work. And I think that is one of the most wonderful things about this show as well, is that we make terrible, terrible things easy to digest and actually fun.
Well, that's how you get through it. It's funny you mentioned that. The first film I remember where they used that technique was American Werewolf in London, because I had heard it was this incredible horror film, and I went to see it, and it starts off with that blue moon, you saw me standing alone, and you're expecting to see someone's head being ripped off or something, and it was a genius, ironic start to a film. So it's the same idea. That Nat King Cole song is so beautiful, it's almost hard to even believe that they could capture that much beauty on one record. I love that song. It's absolutely gorgeous. I have very eclectic taste in music as well, but I like anything that has a sense of honesty in it. I don't care if it's death metal, Nat King Cole, hip-hop. I don't care. Once the honesty comes through, I'm there.
Yeah. Well, I think music lovers are sort of like the people on the beach with the metal detector. They're shuffling through an entire beach of sand to find those little metallic nuggets of valuable material. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. You'll get a few you'll get a few Coke bottles tops, and you'll get a few cans. But now and again, you might find a Rolex watch or a ring or something.
yeah. And I think this is what people don't realize, and I noticed this when I was editing a song over the weekend with my bandmate, is he kept telling me, oh man, I'm tired, it's done, let's stop editing. And I'm like, no, there's tiny little bits in there, just that there, you know. And then you listen to it again, and he's like, oh, there's another little thing there, and there. And it seems like it's endless, it seems like it's relentless. But because I was relentless, because I wasn't prepared to give up, actually managed to perfect the song, right? That's what persistence now gives us. That's what that ability to not take no for an answer, to not leave well enough alone in the positive sense of the word, that's the very antithesis to psychopathy in a lot of ways, because you're capable of persevering through your frustration, through your anger, through all those displeasures in order to create something beautiful.
Oh, yeah, they wouldn't even understand that. They would actually steal another person's song and say that they were singing and they wrote it.
Yeah.
That's what they do. And they wouldn't, to them it would be just the, they wouldn't understand the process of creating it. Just take it. It's mine.
Now, here's another thing. Do they actually believe their own BS?
Yeah, I think at some levels they do. Because they think they're God. They think they're God, they think they can get away with anything. And they have, because they have, like, you know, testicles of titanium, there's a kind of a hubris there that's like, it's beyond delusion. They actually really absolutely do believe, I think, in most cases, their BS. I really do believe that's true. That's why they can pass lie detector tests.
They can pass lie detector tests? Well, like absolutely. All of them? How verified is that?
Oh, very verified. And it actually has been shown that they can actually, the more you put them in the lie detector test, the better they get at dodging it.
Wow.
They don't have any kind of internal self-reflection. When they're lying, you see, what happens is, suppose a psychopath robbed the bank, right? And he was a suspect in the robbery. And they had good evidence against him, but not all the evidence. As far as he's concerned, he didn't do it because he hasn't been caught yet. That's their logic, right? Mm-hmm. The logic is, he didn't rob the bank because he hasn't been caught yet. So you put them under a polygraph, and when you ask him, did you rob the bank? Well, in their warped psychopathic consciousness, he hasn't robbed the bank because he hasn't been caught yet. You understand? It's only when he gets caught robbing the bank that he's robbed the bank. Otherwise, he's not responsible for it. There's no sense of any kind of owning up to any kind of responsibility. It doesn't exist.
That reminds me of a Robert Redford film called 3 Days of the Condor. He's a young agent, and he comes back to his office, and everybody's been killed. And he just gets left hung out to dry by the agency. And he has this conversation with a section chief towards the end of the film, where he says, "What's wrong with you people? You think that not being caught in a lie is the same thing as telling the truth."
That's it. That's exactly what they're like. This is the ass law, criminal psychologists, law enforcement agencies dealing with like mafia guys and stuff. That's what they're like. Henry Hill, who the movie's Goodfellas was based on. When I lived in New York, a boss I had, when I was first starting out, I used to paint houses. And my boss had the painting contracting company. And he used to do contracting work for Henry Hill and that gang that were in the Goodfellas movie. And he said Henry Hill was the most dishonest person he ever met in his life. He said he would rub the eyeball out of your head, right? And unless there was some witness there apart from you, and or even video evidence, he would never admit he did it. He said he never met, in a way, that was one of the first psychopaths I can remember being told about. I didn't have that kind of language back then to describe them. But he said to me that, like, this guy had absolutely no, to him, lying and the truth were just completely arbitrary. He never told the truth to anyone in his life ever. And he never, ever served anyone other than himself. And that's why he turned all his own friends in. Not because he had a crisis like in that movie Goodfellas. It was simply to save his own hide.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they'll sell their own grandmother for a nickel. You heard that saying?
Yeah. When he died, I was listening to the Howard Stern show, because he used to go on the Howard Stern show a lot, and I wanted to hear what Howard Stern said about him. And Howard Stern was saying he was the most disgusting human being I've ever known. He had absolutely no decency in him. You know, he would lie, he would let you down. Like, he was supposed to appear in some Howard Stern movie, and he tried to change the contract at the last moment. He just lived in the world of swindling and lying people. He knew no other way to live.
Now, if you don't have any decency, what room does that leave for men like us? You've seen the movie The Dark Knight, and recall the interaction between Harvey Two-Face and Batman towards the end of the film when Harvey's kidnapped Commissioner Gordon's family. and he was saying that basically we failed. We didn't get rid of the crime in Gotham because we were trying to be decent men in an indecent time. And I thought that was quite profound for me. And one of my mates has been kind of shafted a little bit lately. He's had bad relationships with his missus and all of this kind of thing. And people that he's been very generous to, giving nothing back and only taking more. And I said to him that same line, you know, that's our problem, man. That is our problem. We're decent men in an indecent time.
Yeah, and that was even shown in that movie. What was it? The Untouchables, the busting the gangs in Chicago, Elliot Ness and all those guys back in their day. And you see how it was decency and being good is what got the two who were killed, Sean Connery and the other guy. And Sean Connery, you know, the guy came to kill him, and he beat him up, and he says, "Get out of here, you scumbag." He goes, "You brought a knife to a gunfight." And what he didn't, because he let the guy go, it gave the guy with the machine gun on the roof a chance to shoot him. It was the act of humanity is what brought the two guys down in that film. And that's what that film really showed. And it was a pivotal scene in there. It was actually based on a Russian silent film where the actor, I forget his name, he was a big star back then, the dark, good-looking Italian guy. And he grabs a baby that's going down in a baby carriage down the steps. And he has to make the decision to save the baby and put himself in danger. And he does. He saves the baby and he kills the bad guy. And that was the pivotal point in the film where compassion finally paid off for the cops.
Mm. Now, unfortunately, it sort of works the opposite in the system, right? I've said for a long time that justice is not a natural state. It certainly doesn't exist in nature. You know, you never see a lion being killed by a herd of gazelle or something like that because the lion ate one of their babies, do you? No, it doesn't happen.
I disagree.
No?
I disagree. There are videos on YouTube, believe it or not, Finney, that show herds of wildebeest beating the crap out of lions.
I've seen that video,
It doesn't happen all the time, but there's a great metaphor and lesson there for us.
Yeah.
There's one where you see a zebra saving her baby, and it actually kills the lioness. Mm. It stamps on it while it's under the water. And that shows you that even in the natural world, this Darwinism stuff, it's not necessarily true.
I'm arguing something different here. Because I'm talking about justice, self-defense, and herd mentalities, vigilante justice. That's what exists in nature. But a trial, facts, evidence, corroborations, testimonies, fairness, an actual system, so that if somebody is murdered or their private property damaged or stolen or something of that nature, there is a comeuppance for that person without the necessity for violence necessarily. There'll be a civil way of proceeding things, and that certainly doesn't exist in nature. It's called the law of the jungle in the nature, and we've created a completely different system. Now, our system would work if it was actually applied. You know what I'm saying? Because the problem is we've got psychos running the judicial system, psychos making all the laws, and manipulating everybody into following all of this BS. Whereas the very concept of it, at its core, the lie that they tell everybody, if that was true, it would be great. But it can only be made artificially. Right? This is why I don't believe necessarily in that karmic idea of good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people, because I don't think that you can actually rely on nature to do that for you. You either have to do that yourself, or you have to have a system that is not corrupt in order to enforce that will and to make society fair, make society just, make society safe.
Yeah, it's the wisdom of Solomon thing. We don't have, like you said, the justice system, if it worked as it was applied, it would be wonderful. It would be absolutely a utopian in terms of delivering a sense of fairness in society. But as you said, it's corrupt. So what happens, so this is also why there are no psychopaths in indigenous cultures. They just don't exist because they kill them off. As soon as they recognize them, they kill them because they realize that the whole tribe is in extreme danger because of this one parasite in there. so he'll be thrown off a cliff or something while they go on a hunting trip. Whether he'll be used as bait or something. But
This reminds me. This is something I wanted to ask you, Thomas. Should being a psychopath, a clinically diagnosed psychopath, be a death penalty offence? Because you cannot possibly be of use to humanity if you're a psychopath, and there's no coming back from that. Like, I was wondering of that idea, and I find it poses too many moral grey areas to ever institute.
No, I would be totally against that for a few reasons. One, I think everyone is entitled to human rights if they're human. So they can't just do it. That's like eugenics. That would be just like eugenics. And they would, and you know what happened, Vinny? They would kill the poor psychopaths, and the rich ones like Tony Blair would still get like knighthoods. Do you know how the system works yourself? So yeah. They just extrapolate the current justice system to that. But also, I think you can teach them Pavlovian conditioning in some cases, that like, do, you know, behave yourself. And sometimes you can get them stopped. We'll talk about it later.
Indeed. We'll be right back.
And turn on the mic with a thumb stroke, subtle touch, cuddle clutch. Is this thing on like the flame with Mrs. King Kong this spring gone? Sing a song of slap happy crappiness. He came to blow like it was strapped to his nappy chest. Surely I jest. The best on a wireless mic, not an eye test. Yet I digress. But why stress? Try and remember when maybe bit the tender skinned baby Silla Gwendolyn. The type to hit
and welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to about the show that's about getting depressed and then going through with a digress. My very special guest is, hey, that rhymes three times. Hey, I just rhymed again. And there's Thomas Sheridan, who wrote the book Puzzling People, The Labyrinth of the Psychopath. And I do believe that your research material and the interviews that you've done over the years have made a fracking huge impact, right? Like, it can't be calculated nor underestimated, I think. And I wonder, do you recognize the importance of yourself? Do you realize what a great man you are?
Well, I don't know, really. I don't know. I live in a country and I live in a small town where no one knows who I am. But occasionally, like when I go to a city like Dublin, people stop me on the streets and it shocks me. Oh, you're Thomas Sheridan. I've seen you on YouTube, or I've seen your videos, or I heard you. So it is quite amazing to me. No, I'm not aware of it because it's just the kind of person I am. I live in a kind of a bubble in my own mind, and I'm not really aware of like of my impact around the world until people tell me these things. And there's something wrong with me that way, and I still don't kind of believe that. And I says, it's not really true. I'm not being deliberately humble or anything like that. It's just my nature. I've always been kind of like that. I'm unbelievably easygoing. You know, I'm just really am. It's probably a good thing because it keeps me out of trouble.
Well, it's a musician thing. Musicians take criticism sometimes personally, but they also are very, very reluctant to profess how good they are, even when they're really, really good. The best musicians, at least. And I was telling my bandmate this, and he says, oh, I don't worry about getting criticised anymore. And I go, why not? He goes, because people don't criticise me anymore. Because he practices 4 hours a night.
Well, it's like I think it's an Irish thing too, as well, because if you're like famous or well known in Ireland and or anything, like I'm talking about, like even you're really well known, there's, you know, even the politicians, when they walk into a pub or a restaurant, someone will say to them, "Oh, not this gobshite again," you know. So it's like, if there's something in this culture here where you're not, it's a healthy thing too, where you're always reminded that you're no better than the rest of us. And so I think that's an inherent Irish thing. I think it's one of our better traits, that it's like it puts a safety valve on you. Because you look at what happens when it doesn't work in someone like Bono. And he thinks he actually is some kind of like savior.
Did you ever see the South Park episode?
Of Bono? The biggest turd. That was a great one.
Oh, that's hilarious.
That was a classic. Except the accent was terrible. But it was terrible. It was like this like hybrid South African Scottish accent. But it was like Randy Marsh had the world's record for the biggest bell movement. Mm-hmm. And Bono beat him. And that was brilliant. That was brilliant.
And it wasn't because Bono was... what was it? It's because Bono himself was the Bell Movement record. Like he actually got where he was born, you know, as the world's largest turd, and he got sprayed and loved, and he grew, and because he knew that he was a number two, he had to be number one at everything so that he would never be number two. Nobody would ever call him number two.
those guys, when they're funny, they're genius.
Oh yeah,
I love Randy Marsh. I love that character. He's like one of the best characters. The father, that's one of the best. He's so neurotic, but yet at the same time, you feel so bad for him.
Yeah. I'm so startled. You know, I've got this really wacky idea that we should really start. You know how David Icke just started up this new TV studio, right? I think a non-centralized cartoon studio with heaps of truther animators and writers and directors and voice talent and stuff from all over the world. Create cartoons together, truther cartoons, you know, like a South Park, but on steroids.
Oh, I've been saying that for years. If we had those kinds of resources, it would be like a mixture of South Park, Monty Python, but better. If we had those resources, we'd rule the world. Well, yeah, no, it's a shame. I wish animation was brought down to the same way Photoshop and audio recording is. It's still not completely accessible to the ordinary guy, but the day it is, really good animation is accessible to us. Watch out, world, because I'll definitely be using it.
Yeah, I mean, a program that does for animation what YouTube has done for video.
Yeah, or you know, the music programs have done for recording, to bring it, make it very accessible. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I think there are a number of programs that are capable of doing that. They automatically animate things for you. Like you can draw a head and arms and what have you, and then instructs the certain parts of the image to do certain things, and then it renders and then animates the entire image for you as if it was in real motion.
Yeah, I've seen them, but they're still kind of crude.
We're
a few years away from the big one.
It's like cameras, for example, used to cost like what, 100 G's for a you know, television / movie camera.
Yeah, HD camera would be like $300,000, not like 15 years ago.
Yeah, and now they're like, you got one on your freaking phone.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it? Yep.
Okay, so if it can be that easy, then surely we can come up with a technological solution to replace 500 Korean animators.
Yeah, I agree. That's the next one. That's the next stage. I'll be on that like white on rice as soon as that comes out, because I have loads of ideas for cartoons and stuff.
Oh, mate, it's going to be good. Now, this is another thing. I believe people need to adopt more creative outlets in order to go against the New World Order. Okay, so it's all very fun and fine and good to go out and start raving in people's faces and telling them about the scumbaggery and telling them you're a slave and blah, blah, blah. 9/11's an inside job. The vaccines are poison, la, 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 la. But if it ain't working and you've been doing it for 10 years, change frickin' tact. Okay? This is what people are doing. It's I came up with a new definition of insanity. When all evidence is to the contrary and you still keep doing it, believing it'll work, that's insane.
Yeah, and it never changed tact. Write a song. Start a radio show. You know, approach people differently. That's a good one. Do it with a smile on your face rather than walking around saying, we're all screwed. Do it with a smile on your face, you know?
Mm. Sometimes you need that, we're all screwed, in order to snap you out of your happy little happy-go-lucky lifestyle, right? Because I think it was when I was first getting into this sort of information, it was in the fear paradigm. And it really messed me up. It destroyed my entire life, basically. You become angry, you become depressed, you become despondent, you become
apathetic. Yeah, lose relationships.
All of them. Yeah. You know, they just disappear. And I think that's a necessary evil in a lot of cases. You've got to take that first step. You've got to be prepared to release all of that illusion out of your life and go through that traumatic, suffering, painful process of your awakening. Otherwise, you don't actually really see the value in going through what you went through. And as a result, you don't really keep to your lessons. You don't really take those lessons on board. And you wind up becoming the very negativity that you wanted to start fighting against.
We have to learn to understand that destruction is not the end of the world. It's an evolutionary step. It's like, I can always remember the one town I lived in, there was a factory there. And when the factory closed, everyone was like, oh, it's the end of the world. It's the end of the world. And when the factory, some people wanted to reopen the factory. And if they were like, when it wouldn't happen, they'd say it was the end of the world. And eventually what happened was they knocked down the factory and they built a beautiful park. And that was like, that factory had to die to make this beautiful park, which now employs people because they have concerts in the summer and they have events and fairs and crafts and arts fairs there. And it changed things. And that's the same thing with your life. Sometimes it's like the tarot card in the tarot. The tarot has to fall. It has to be demolished. But just because there's rubble lying on the ground doesn't mean it's going to be there forever. You have to clear it out to begin again. People have to understand that when they're going to that stage where they're waking up and they lose their friends and all that kind of thing, that's the tower falling. But that doesn't mean the tower won't rise again, and it will. And it'll be more beautiful.
Yeah. In 1776 foot tall skyscraper owned by Larry Silverstein, the tower has come back, baby. Thomas Sheridan, I think it's thomassheridanarts.com, if I'm not mistaken. thomassheridanarts.com, ladies and gentlemen. Check out his interviews. You go Google this man. He's got great stuff all over the web.
I have a Sunday night radio show called The Philosophy of Health.
See you again sometime, folks. Thanks for listening.